from 90.9 WBUR, I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, after yesterday's shooting rampage in Texas, questions again about gun laws.
He bought four weapons in total. Two of them were bought in Colorado. Two of them were bought here in Texas.
We'll talk with some health researchers and religious leaders about the effects of the Texas shooting. Also today, the use of anonymous jurors in some high-profile legal cases in Massachusetts. And new research on marijuana use in teenagers.
We've seen really dramatic decreases in alcohol use rates and in tobacco use rates. So overall, there's been an increase in the number of kids who don't use any of those substances, and they're less likely to try marijuana in the first place.
Plus, a local engineering school that prides itself on the high number of women who graduate and women's roles in redesigning a part of the college.
When you're training women versus training men, the women tend to actually pay a little bit more attention, I found.
That's all coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The details are still emerging, but authorities say the shooting at the Sutherland Springs First Baptist Church in Texas yesterday has been linked to a domestic dispute, and the gunman appears to have had a violent past. At least 26 people were killed, 20 others were hurt after 26-year-old Devin Kelly opened fire during Sunday services. Here's Freeman Martin, regional director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, at a press conference this morning.
The suspect's mother-in-law attended this church. We know that he had made threatening texts from him. We want to get that out there that this was not racially motivated. It wasn't over religious beliefs. There was a domestic situation going on within the family and the in-laws.
The Pentagon has confirmed that Devin Kelly is a former member of the U.S. Air Force. The New York Times is now reporting that Kelly was court-martialed in 2012 for assaulting his wife and breaking his infant stepson's skull. He was sentenced to 12 months confinement and was given a bad conduct discharge. Texas Governor Greg Abbott has said that Sunday's rampage is the largest mass shooting in that state's history. It's also the deadliest church shooting in U.S. history. Joining us to talk about this is Reverend Nancy Taylor. She's senior minister and CEO at the Old South Church in Boston. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
Also on the line with us is Reverend Mariama White-Hammond. She's minister at Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
I'd like to ask both of you, just to start out, how are people in your communities reached out or reacting? What are you hearing about this? Reverend Taylor.
Our hearts are, again, broken and breaking for this small, close church, this unimaginably tragic event. Our folks are, you know, everybody feels helpless, hopeless. How many more times do we just have to wrap a broken community in prayer when this violence seems so unnecessary?
Mm-hmm. And Reverend White-Hammond.
Yeah, I think, we find some similar things. I think people are saddened by the events. I also think there is some level of concern, some fear. This question of, like, is there any place that is safe? Mm-hmm. And then this question is, you know, it seems like they happen, and everybody responds in the moment, and then we just go back to living life the same way and don't seem to be able to come together to do anything that we think might change the situation. So I think that, as you know, Reverend Nancy said, it increases the helplessness because you'd feel like, unfortunately, we don't seem to be able to do anything together to address these.
Well, I want to talk about the security issues first, because earlier this year, Texas did pass a law making it easier for houses of worship to enlist volunteer security guards. And that, in part, was a policy proposed because of what happened in Charleston, South Carolina in 2015, which was the previously deadliest shooting, church shooting attack. So I'm just wondering, in terms of security in a church, how do you sort of walk the line between welcoming people, especially new people, to your congregations, and now dealing with something like this that has become, unfortunately, a reality. Reverend Taylor.
At Old South Church in Boston, we realize we live in a new world, a new normal. Our ushers and welcomers are trained to practice a posture we call welcoming and watchful. That is to say, they have to remain attentive, eyes trained on the open door, on visitors, tourists, strangers. They're asked to look out for worrying behaviors, the agitated visitor, the unattended backpack. They keep a watch on over the people in the section that they have been assigned. So we've been trying to step up our response to this while maintaining an open door. The balance is not easy. We are charged to be a welcoming community. This is God's house. We have a theological commitment to the God who commissions us to welcome the stranger, to keep our doors open and to be as welcoming as we can, but also as watchful as we can.
And when did you decide to step up your response and your security like this to have welcoming and watchful ushers?
Oh, I'd say it's been 8 years or so now, but then increasingly, the Marathon bombers, that happened just outside our doors. We know that the two bombers were in our church the Friday before, and, we know we're a soft target, but we also want to be really thoughtful, and it's walking a fine line. It's a very difficult balance.
So if it was 8 years ago, then it hasn't changed much since then, or you've had to intensify those efforts with discussions first starting 8 years ago? I'm just trying to be clear.
We're intensifying. But I think we started some years ago. Things have been, have been happening in Boston right here. If it's not a terrorist, we have people who are, high on drugs or other things. So you're very porous to the world outside your doors in a city like Boston. And we want our place to be secure to our elders, our children, our babes in arms. We have a lot of vulnerable people who come into a church. And so we are in the business of trying to provide a very welcoming place, but also being watchful.
Reverend White Hammond?
Yeah, we have a somewhat similar experience. For us, we are an AME church. We were particularly struck by the events in Charleston and really had to think about how we would respond. For us, for instance, we had to make sure that we want to be a welcoming space. We are a historically Black church, and so a lot of our folks are African-American, but it was important for us to say, we know what racial profiling looks like. We don't want to do reverse racial profiling in the light of this event. And so, as Reverend Taylor is saying, it's this fine line you have to walk. How do you make sure that, quite frankly, we want to be open even to the Dylan Roofs of the world, and we don't want them to have the ability to kill people. And I think that that's this real challenge, because you, on one hand, a church should be a sacred place. On the other hand, and I think this is the case in this case, you have families that are in crisis, and you want them to come to your church. Mm-hmm. You want people who are struggling to know that they can come to your church. My aunt, who's a pastor, says you're not a real congregation until at least one of your members is hearing voices. If you're not, really reaching people in need, then you're not doing your job. Mm-hmm. At the same time, it does mean that you could be more vulnerable, not just to a person that you don't know, but maybe, quite frankly, somebody that you do know that's hit a point where they're really struggling. You might think they're coming from help for help. They could unfortunately be coming with other thoughts in mind. So I think that's this big challenge. We can't become a closed fortress. It would violate the very reason that we exist. But it does also mean that there's a level of vulnerability we have to negotiate.
Is your church taking specific steps like the Old South Church is and sort of telling ushers to be more welcoming and watchful and telling them how to be attentive and look for certain things?
These are some of the same things that we put into place post-Charleston. Mother Emanuel, you know, within our denomination, people began to have this conversation more seriously. So these were some of those measures are the same exact ones that we have already put into place. And then there is this question: what do you do in the case of an active shooter? My husband is on the security team, for instance, and we try to be careful around the offering, and you know, just try as much as we can not to make ourselves openly vulnerable. We have our youth meet in a separate building. We've often had security there just in case. But the reality is there's lots of risks. We also are very careful around making sure that we never expose our children to any kind of sexual abuse too, right? So as a church, we actually think pretty carefully and try to be pretty intentional about thinking, how do we make this a safe space for everyone who needs help, and how do we make sure that people who show up here don't experience more damage here, right? This should be a place, a refuge for everyone. And some people's issues, right, inflict damage on others. So, I think that, again, you know, this is not a new issue. Certainly for us, after Mother Emanuel, we had to take a deeper look, and this came up in staff meeting today. We're sort of going to take another review, in light of this recent shooting.
You mean at a staff meeting today, folks asked, are we going to do anything specific now regarding this?
Yeah. And I think Pastor Hammond was sort of said, you know, this again, it's a really hard balance that we have to strike, because some piece of this is also about fear. This is horrific and should never have happened. And the reality is the level of fear that one feels kind of can sometimes be directly related to how much news you're consuming. It's still more likely that people, you know, will deal with car accidents and other sorts of things in their lives. But the fear is very real, and you have to address that fear. You can't ignore it. But how do we address it in a way that doesn't go overboard and make us feel maybe increasingly unsafe because we're being so vigilant, we are not being welcoming.
Reverend Taylor, I'm wondering, you talked about telling ushers how to look for folks who may be at risk. How exactly do you do that? And what happens if an usher reports that they think someone is agitated? What do you do?
Yeah, we have a couple of systems in place. So we have our front desk receptionist is the recipient of news. The head usher, who is a roving usher, is doesn't have an assigned place. So if somebody says, I see a problem here, one of those people will be identified. And we also always have on staff and on Sunday and whenever we have big events in the building, our senior sexton, who is actually hired to serve a little bit as a muscle, he's a big, big, gentle guy. And the word sexton is a Latin word meaning keeper of keys. He lives in the building and he is our head guy for the building security. Mm-hmm. So we have systems and calling 911 and in terms of training the ushers, we actually do workshops with role-playing and that sort of thing so that people can try to get an idea of what it might be like. I think that, Jesus admonished his followers to be wise as serpents and gentle as doves. And I think for many of us, we've sort of focused on gentle as doves, and we're now needing to put some more emphasis on wise as serpents. So we're going to stay gentle, but we need to up our wisdom game a little bit here.
I wonder if when you hear the reports of what happened in Texas and we hear that Devin Kelly's mother-in-law went to this the Sutherland Springs First Baptist Church and there had been some threatening texts going on, when you hear about a potentially contentious family situation, what do you do as a pastor, and what do you do in terms of not crossing that line? Just briefly, Reverend White-Hammond.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. I mean, I think the big question is, it is very hard. You want to hear people out and be supportive. But I think once you get the sense that a person could hurt themselves or others, I think our responsibility is not simply to that person, but also to protecting the other people that might be hurt. You know, I'm youth pastor here. I've also served in a number of roles where I've worked with folks who have some history of violence. I think you can love, support, and hope for people to get into a better place. But when you notice that they're maybe not doing better and there's a concern that, you know, their actions might affect others, sometimes you do have to step in and say, I think you need to take a time out. So I have had to, you know, get people to commit themselves to go to the police sometimes, but we go with them. I've had some folks who have reached points in their mental health where I've been concerned, particularly about them hurting themselves, and I had to say, I think you need a break. And so I do think when someone has a history of violence, you really do have to take those threats seriously and do an assessment of what's going on. Because while you want to help them, you also want to make sure that nobody else is lost. And quite frankly, in this case, this man looks like he took his own life. So it wasn't even safe for him to be out and about.
Right.
And so I do think we also have to be far more cognizant about mental health. I completely pray with people, but sometimes prayer is not enough.
Okay.
Right? Sometimes you need other help.
Hmm.
And I do think it's also important to note there's lots of people around the world who are struggling with mental health, but we're the only country where those people have such heavy access to firearms. So I think we can't talk about this without recognizing that this is not simply about mental health.
Okay, we're just about out of time. Just, Reverend Taylor, last question. Are we reaching a point where we might need security guards at churches?
Oh, God help us. I hope not. I hope not. You know, I think we all need to just talk to our neighbors, you know, not let these folks be left out there in their anguish and their pain, do more about gun control. You know, all people are welcome at our churches, but not all behaviors. And as Reverend White Hammond is saying, we just really need to be clear about that, as clear as we can be.
All right. Reverend Nancy Taylor, Senior Minister and CEO at the Old South Church, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Also, Reverend Mariama White Hammond is a minister at the Bethel AME Church in Jamaica Plain. Thanks to you as well, Reverend.
Thank you.
And public health policymakers are saying that while it might seem as if mass shootings like what happened in Texas yesterday are inevitable, there are three key steps that can be taken right now. Joining us to talk about this is Sandro Galea. He's dean of the Boston University School of Public Health. And Dean Galea, you've written a Boston Globe piece titled, Three Steps We Can Take on Gun Violence Now. The first, you say, is keep guns away from dangerous people. Fairly straightforward. And even though the details are still coming out in this particular case in Texas, that definitely was not done here. Do we know why?
Simply put, we have never really tried to have a comprehensive system of universal background checks, which is not that different than what we have for driver's licenses, where you cannot just get yourself a car, but essentially, if you try hard enough, you can get yourself a gun. So we are far from a system that catches people who have malintent, and poll after poll show that all Americans are in favor of that, and Americans of all stripes, including gun owners.
But again, do we know anything about what does the research tell us, if there is such a thing, concretely about what background checks might do?
Well, as you know, one of the challenges we have with research is that research into this area has been underfunded for decades, really. And as a result, there is a lot that we do not know. However, we do know that the states with the more comprehensive universal background checks are states that have lower gun-related injury, and that those states can serve as an example for the rest of the country.
The second thing that you say of the three things to try to deal with this is using smart guns. Can you explain?
Yeah, smart guns are approaches to guns which are essentially linked to a user, that a gun cannot fall in the wrong hands. Coupled with background checks, right? You can imagine a system where we make sure that people who we have reason to believe will have bad intentions, will not get their hands on guns. This technology is available and could be widely introduced.
You know, we've talked about this before, and I believe that there is some minimal research anyway on smart guns. And some folks have questioned whether using technology to try to link a weapon to a particular user is really effective, because it can be very expensive. And then, of course, you get into the whole underground world of stolen weapons and all of that. Is that the best way to go in trying to deal with this?
Is that the best way to go? Well, I think the best way to go is to have a comprehensive set of gun safety regulations that span the gamut, from making sure that you have background checks to making sure that you do not have guns in the hands of people who have demonstrated violent tendencies. The ideas that I proposed in the editorial were really trying to get this kind of conversation going, to say, here are just three ideas. These are only three ideas. There are many papers that list a whole set of other ideas, and some of these ideas we have better evidence for than others, but we know much more than we think we know, and there are very specific things that we can do and we can do right now.
Mm-hmm. The third thing that you say in your editorial is that we should rethink concealed carry laws. What does that mean?
More and more states are passing concealed carry laws, which essentially reintroduce guns into our daily circulation in the way we haven't seen since the mid-19th century, and hard to countenance the push for a federal reciprocity around concealed carry laws, which would make it perfectly legal to carry a concealed gun in Massachusetts if you've been licensed to do so in Texas. And there are studies, including some done by our team, that show that states where concealed carry is essentially automatic, where law enforcement cannot modulate or regulate who gets concealed carry permits, have higher homicide rates than states that do not.
Your editorial today compares guns as a public health threat to cholera. That sounds extreme. Some folks might think that that's extreme. Why did you compare those two in a public health realm?
Yeah, I'm not sure why it's extreme. Cholera is something that kills people. We, 150 years ago, thought it was acceptable that poor children had a high likelihood of dying from cholera that they contracted from drinking contaminated water. Now we no longer find it acceptable. Now it's unacceptable to us. Today we consider it acceptable that we have as many people dying from guns as we have from motor vehicle accidents. And we shall look back on this period in hopefully 10 years from now, or maybe 20 years from now, and recognize that we found something acceptable that should have been unacceptable.
Sandro Galeas, Dean of the Boston University School of Public Health. You can find a link to his piece titled Three Steps We Can Take on Gun Violence Now at our website, radioboston.org. Sandro Galeas, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The controversial use of anonymous jurors is playing out in legal and media circles in Massachusetts. Federal Judge William Young has released the names of the jurors in the terrorism trial of David Wright of Everett. That was after Judge Young initially ruled that he didn't want jurors' names, quote, plastered permanently on the internet. So he first said that he would release the names if news organizations agreed to some conditions. This radio station, WBUR, refused to accept those conditions, and Judge Young changed his mind. Joining me to talk about this case is David Boeri, a senior reporter at WBUR. Hi, David.
Hi, Deb.
Also with us, Nancy Gertner. She's a former federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. She's also WBUR's legal analyst. Hello.
Hello.
So, David, let's start with you. You began contacting these jurors today. Remind us a little bit about this case first. David Wright was convicted of supporting terrorist organizations.
That's right. David Daoud Wright was convicted last month of conspiracy to provide material support to a designated foreign terrorist organization. That organization was ISIS. He was also found guilty of conspiracy to commit acts of terrorism across national boundaries. Part of it involved a plot to kill a woman in New York, an activist who drew disdain for Muslims and endorsed a cartoon, an anti-Muslim cartoon session. So Wright was convicted, and the next thing was we sought the jury list. And for a long time in this jurisdiction, the First District, it's been common practice for judges to release the jury lists, the names and streets and addresses of jurors in a prompt fashion and to turn them over. And then we're on to looking for them.
Mm-hmm. And so in this case, that didn't happen.
No, because in this case, Judge Young imagined a threat and he talked about that threat. There's no example of it ever occurring, but it was the idea that the jurors' names would be put on a list and the list would go up on the internet, so they would always be there. And on that basis of an imagined danger, he said he should not release the list to us unless we came up with a protective order. Now, a protective order is a classic example of what's called prior restraint. And the First Amendment severely restricts the ability of the government to impose a prior restraint. So our response to that was we would not abide by prior restraint. We would not abide and provide any kind of protective orders for him to decide. And so that was it. Now, we went back and forth, and the judge backed down. He says that upon reconsideration, he's going to release the list to us. He has released that list, but he still reinstated his concern about internets and the use of internets and private privacy, I should say, of jurors. Hmm.
Nancy, what's your take on this?
Well, I thought that the law was pretty clear. And the law was pretty clear that proceedings in the court are public and that includes the jurors' names and addresses. You can always tell a juror that they don't have to talk to the press because they don't have to. They can decline. You can always tell the jurors that if anyone harasses them, that they immediately get in touch with the judge. But to do so in advance and say you can't have access, it seems to me is against the First Amendment. The rule has been 40 years ago when there were mob cases coming out of New York where there had been credible threats, and we're talking about real threats, which is the defendant would say, hey, I'm going to actually kill juror number three. Mm. Specific threats as against individual jurors. The juror was then permitted to be anonymous, but the court had to make findings to that extent. What's troubling here is that these are not findings about any particular threat or findings about any particular juror. These are findings about the ubiquity of information on the internet.
Right.
And that's what the problem is.
So that is, the judge acknowledged himself that there were no explicit threats to anyone in this process. Yet upon that imagination of a danger, he required the protective order. And, you know, it has to be said, the juries in trials make great sacrifice. It is serving the country. They've been likened in one of the key rulings that set this precedent about release of their names to citizen soldiers because they are soldiers. But in some ways, like soldiers, they're called upon to do unpleasant duties. And one of them may be dealing with members of the press. And my attitude has always been...
That's unpleasant, David? That's like an interesting concession. Okay.
We go to the doors, we knock, we call. We do not publish the names of jurors. We do not use the names of people that don't want to be quoted. We go to their doors and we ask. And if I exercise my First Amendment rights, they exercise theirs. They can tell me, go fly a kite, and I'm gone.
But I want to go back to this nature of technology because I think it's an interesting question. Shouldn't a judge have to look at this and consider what technology might mean for the safety of folks who are involved? And when you've got ISIS as a threat, this isn't just some mobster on the streets who might do this. This is sort of an international terrorist group that we're talking about. Is it a judge's first responsibility to try to protect jurors and the judicial process?
Well, first of all, what's interesting about this is that this came up not just in the Wright case, which involved ISIS, but came up in the New England compounding case,
right,
which had nothing remotely like that, where the judge was likewise protective about juror privacy because of the internet. The internet has certainly changed our analysis of the First Amendment, But it cannot be that the internet provides a justification for shutting down access. It seems to me there has to be other ways of addressing those issues. And as I said, the usual ways of addressing those issues was to tell a juror, you know, your names will be made public, but you can turn down. If anyone harasses you, let us know.
But the alternative to this is people being judged by anonymous jurors in this country. And that is not consistent with democratic rule, the idea that they're unknown. It was all the way till in U.S. history, all the way to the 1970s, before we had that first anonymous jury list.
And that was litigated precisely because of the feeling that jurors who believed that their identity would be protected would, in fact, be less responsible than jurors who knew that they had to stand up in open court and say, guilty or not guilty. All of this, by the way, contrasts. There are cases that have been reversed, for example, if the judge's court officer accidentally left the family out of the courtroom during public voir dire selection. So significant do we regard the selection of jurors and their decision-making process to make it public.
And this is a right that has gone back in our practice to the days of the Norman conquest of Britain. It is a long-standing recognition. You know, Edward R. Murrow said, "We are not the descendants of fearful people." And if we are to have transparency, which is the key to fairness and justice in the courts, if we're to have that, then we have to have a public list, unless there's stipulated findings that people are in danger, of who the jurors are. You know, Judge Young famously dressed down the shoe bomber, Richard Reed, by telling him, "Sir, here's the flag. These colors don't run. We're not afraid of you." And in the end, if we're going to have democratic rule and justice in a democracy, we have to have a public transparency.
Let's talk briefly. Judge Gertner mentioned the New England Compounding Center case. And David, I just want to ask you a couple questions about that as well, because the Wright case is affecting that case, as Judge Gertner mentioned. Now, this, of course, involves Glenn Chin, who was the supervising pharmacist at the New England Compounding Center. He was convicted of racketeering and fraud in a case that involved contaminated drugs that resulted in 76 deaths. Now, Chin will not be sentenced until next year, but WBUR wants the jurors' names now.
Right. The judge has responded to our motion by saying, and this, remember, it was last month when there was the conviction, he said he's not going to release the list until January, until sentencing, which we think is without justification, but that he would give us the list earlier if we were willing to come up with a protective order. He cites Young talking about a case that's involved in terrorism for his case, which involves a pharmacist running a dirty lab. And he cites the argument of Young in saying he will not give us the list unless there is a protective order that we submit. We're looking for three things. And this is what was once part of the ruling precedent until recent years, the names, the addresses, with street addresses, because Bob Smith from Boston is not an identifier. That's not an identity. Street addresses, and finally, we want the list released in prompt order. Those were the three standing legs that have been throughout the last
and had always been. This was the rule. In other words, the presumption is public identity, unless you make findings otherwise. And if the ISIS threat is as had been described, then you can make those findings in a particular case. I mean, the internet is going to transform, has transformed so many things. I have a case of someone who was convicted literally 50 years ago of a crime. The conviction was set aside. No one ever believed that he should be prosecuted again. And he is living with the consequences of that set aside conviction, which does not go away on the internet. Does that mean that we shouldn't put proceedings and make them public just in case people will abuse them? We can't live like that. The internet can't be the justification for more secrecy.
Is that why you think we're starting to see judges ask for these kind of deals and conditions on things?
Let me read what Stern said in his response to us. He talked about he was not going to give names or street addresses. Quote, in an age where traditional boundaries of personal privacy are under assault. He refers to what had been the ruling precedent here as part of a more innocent age, quote unquote, with us. So that's
right. But that justifies a complete shutdown of public access to the court. In other words, you're making a generic finding about the internet age or a generic finding about our times. And that can't be the basis for shutting the door totally.
Hmm. All right, David, I just want to make sure that we get to this. Have you started contacting these jurors?
We've started, yes. Yeah. We've started. It's a difficult process. Jurors are afraid. We recognize they're generally reluctant. But we've done this in the Top Chef case. We've done this in the death penalty trial of Gary Sampson. We've done it with the Chin case, the New England Compounding Center case in this one. And we're hoping that, in fact, in the end, Judge Stearns is going to reconsider his position we are going to get that jury list.
Mm. And what do you hope to get from the jurors, David? Tell people what you hope to get from jurors.
So jurors can give you an insight into the process. There's all sorts of things that they can do. They can tell you. They can let you know if there's been wrongdoing in the jury. That's one of them. They give transparency. They inspire confidence in the system. But in the smaller society, somebody could say, oh, Deb Becker. Oh, yeah, I know her. Yeah, she's fair. Or Deb Becker, wait a minute, she's married to the brother of the defendant. So there's that benefit from it. This idea that when people's names are out there, when you have a chance, the Boston Massacre, everybody in this town knew who the jurors were who acquitted the British soldiers who were on trial for killing one of the mob. Everybody knew. And it's that gives strength to the system that Judge Young has called the best in the world.
Mm. Sounds like we'll have some continuing discussions about exactly how to figure this out
handle
it. But before we go, I want to make sure that we bring up something that is happening tomorrow. And this is a case before the State Supreme Judicial Court asking if colleges and universities should be held legally liable when one of their students commits suicide. And this case follows the 2009 suicide of 25-year-old MIT doctoral student Han Nguyen. His family says his suicide was both foreseeable and preventable. I'm wondering, Judge Gertner, should a college be held legally responsible for a student suicide?
Colleges held responsible for the safety of its premises. That's been a long-standing principle. So if the college doesn't provide adequate security and someone gets raped walking to classes or doesn't provide adequate security and someone breaks into your room, that's been litigation for numbers of years. Suicide is obviously a more complicated causal issue. It's one thing to say you left the door unlocked and someone came in. With respect to suicide, you're talking about what was known, what could have been done to prevent it. You're talking about all the complexities of why someone makes that decision. I think the answer is going to be depend upon the facts of the case. The court may well be reluctant, given the complexities of suicide, to ascribe liability to the college.
Right. 18 other colleges have weighed in on this, and they say if they're forced to prevent suicide, one of the big issues here are violations of medical privacy on the part of the students.
Violations.
Do you think that's going to be a real issue?
Well, how else? In other words, the question is if they are going to be held accountable for information that they had, is that going to put pressure on medical privacy? Is that also going to put pressure on autonomy? Is that going to push them to intervene more? In other words, it's not the easy case of the door was unlocked or you didn't have an adequate locking system. This is you have to do something affirmative in order to prevent a suicide, which, as we know from other suicide cases, is complicated and difficult.
All right. Judge Nancy Gertner, a former federal judge and a senior lecturer at Harvard Law School. She's also WBUR's legal analyst. Thanks very much for being
with
us.
Thank you.
And David Boeri, senior reporter at WBUR. Keep up the good fight, David.
Thanks, Deb.
Stay with us. Coming up, do more teenagers use marijuana in states where it's legal? I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. As more and more states legalize marijuana, are more young people using it? Well, new research suggests that the answer is no. There does not seem to be a national increase in teen use of marijuana. The researchers suggest that there are fewer teens considered high risk. Joining us, as she does most Mondays, is Common Health Editor Carrie Goldberg. Welcome.
Thanks, Deb.
So what is this new research?
So it's a paper and a commentary just out today in the journal Pediatrics. And I thought, you know, now that Massachusetts has joined the states that have legalized marijuana and we're expecting retail sales in a few months, I thought it might be of particular interest to residents and especially parents who could be concerned that legalizing recreational marijuana could lead to more teen marijuana use, even though, of course, it still won't be legal for minors.
Right. But the idea is that if kids see that something is legal, then they're more likely to try to figure out how to use it, right?
Right. They're more likely to figure it's okay. So in the debates over legalizing marijuana, opponents have argued that legalization will lead to more marijuana use by teens because their perception of the risk of using marijuana will drop. And exactly as you said, that they figure if it's legal, you know, it must be pretty much okay. But there's been this really interesting paradox in the data. So over the last decade or so, even as more and more states legalized first medical marijuana and then recreational marijuana, the surveys have found no overall rise in the prevalence of adolescents using marijuana.
Which is pretty surprising.
Right. So this study in Pediatrics tried to figure out whether the perception of risk maybe just doesn't matter that much anymore in whether teens use marijuana, or there was another hypothesis that maybe a big drop in adolescent use of alcohol and cigarettes is having an effect.
And there has been a big drop in that, right?
There certainly has. So it's actually this wonderful public health victory that you don't hear about very much, but cigarette smoking among teens is way, way down compared to even a couple of decades ago. But marijuana use is pretty much flat. There's just been a slight decline in the last couple of years.
So how does that all fit together, Carrie? What's the relationship between, say, cigarette smoking and marijuana?
Well, so I spoke with Dr. Sharon Levy. She's the director of the Adolescent Substance Abuse and Addiction Program at Boston Children's Hospital, and she co-wrote a commentary to go with this new paper in Pediatrics. She says the key here is in what researchers call high-risk kids and low-risk kids. So the high-risk kids are the ones who report using alcohol or tobacco because drug use, substance use, tends to go together.
So kids who use one substance are likely to use the others. And, you know, we've seen really dramatic decreases in alcohol use rates over the past 40 years and in tobacco use rates, particularly over the past 20 years. So overall, there's been an increase in the number of kids who don't use any of those substances, and they're a relatively lower risk group and less likely to try marijuana in the first place.
So, and that group of low risk kids has been really growing because there's been so much messaging that, look, smoking and drinking are really unhealthy, especially smoking.
So less smoking, less drinking among teenagers, so then they're generally less likely to use marijuana?
Right. It's almost like smoking can be like a gateway drug to marijuana. But Dr. Levy says at the same time, you've got changes in policy that make kids more likely to think marijuana is okay.
And that pushes rates up. So you're seeing one force pushing rates down and another force pushing rates up. And on average, what we've seen is pretty flat rates. But you have to look at those flat rates next to what's going on with alcohol and tobacco to really see the whole picture.
So from her point of view, this is kind of a glass half empty, right? Like we could have seen drops in the rate of teen marijuana use as dramatic as the drops in alcohol or tobacco use, but there were these countervailing forces.
And some parents might say maybe they'd rather have their kids use marijuana than drink alcohol or smoke cigarettes because there are adverse effects with those things, drunk driving or lung cancer, right?
Right, of course. But I just thought this was an interesting element to add to the discussion. You know, this finding that a big factor in why there's not more teen marijuana use is that kids are drinking and smoking less. So there are just fewer kids that are considered at high risk.
And what about, though, when we hear about the opioid epidemic in teenagers? Well, does the study mention that at all?
So it doesn't mention that, but it does point up really how dramatic the drop in smoking has been among kids. Like even between 2005 and 2016, it dropped by like 50%. It's a huge difference.
And so what does Dr. Levy think needs to be done?
Well, so she says the state should look to strategies that have worked with alcohol and tobacco, like ensuring that taxes make marijuana pricey, restricting the places where it can be used.
The way smoking cigarettes was restricted by secondhand smoke laws, right?
Right, right. And she says education is important.
Parents and other adults who work with kids, and certainly kids themselves, you know, I think there's a role for really making sure that people understand what the risks of marijuana use are to the developing brain. So that's got to be an important part of the package, but it won't be the whole thing because, you know, education alone isn't really enough.
And Deb, Dr. Levy has a special perspective on the risks of marijuana because she's been treating kids with substance use issues for the last 15 years. And she's been sounding the alarm about some of the changes that she's been seeing in the clinic.
In changes in terms of the strains of marijuana that are out there and how powerful marijuana can be?
Right. So she says lately kids have been coming in with different symptoms. She's seeing more psychotic symptoms like hallucinations and paranoia, more of this nasty cyclic vomiting syndrome that's been linked to marijuana use.
And that presumably, those potential side effects could increase the perception of risk. Right?
Yes, if word gets spread around. Right. You know, my favorite quote comes from a leading expert on psychosis at McLean Hospital who tells his students, smoke all the pot you want after you're 30.
Gary Goldberg, editor of WBUR's Common Health. Thank you, as always.
You're welcome.
Only about 20% of engineering degrees in this country go to women. But a prestigious engineering college in Needham is proud to be an outlier. Half its students are women. WBUR's Fred Tice has more and tells us how women affected a recent redesign at Olin College.
The machine shop is a big deal at Olin. The college prides itself on classes with project-based learning. But Daniela Foss, the director of design and fabrication operations at Olin, remembers being discouraged from using the machines in the shop and wants to make sure all students feel comfortable there.
Engineering is so much about being able to produce something at the end, and we haven't really done that in the past.
Foss's colleague, Associate Professor of Mechanical Engineering Aaron Hoover, says the machine shop did not encourage students to build their own projects.
So when Olin started out, we started out with a very traditional shop space where, as a student, you came in with a technical drawing that was, you know, defined to a certain specification, and you would either hand it off to have someone else make it for you, or if you're very lucky, you could make it yourself. And that was actually kind of at odds to a certain degree with the sort of anti-disciplinary, multidisciplinary culture that we have here.
In the welding shop, junior Claire Kincaid is taking advantage of the redesign.
It's been so amazing. We have new printers. We got rid of our old laser cutter that didn't work so well. We have new equipment, new welding bays. I love welding, so I'm really happy about the welding bays. This room is generally just so much nicer than it was.
Kincaid is cutting a poem out of a piece of steel using a plasma torch. She has been working with metal her whole life, but many students at Olin have not. One change to accommodate them, hand tools are no longer strewn about. Junior Sarah Ballantyne says each tool has a place on a board now, along with a label saying what size it is and what it's called.
If someone told me, hey, hand me a dead blow hammer, prior to this wall, I would have no idea what they were talking about, and I probably would have handed them a mallet. So when someone says, I need a, you know, 19-millimeter metric wrench, you can say, oh, got it, here you go, just by grabbing it off the wall.
Ballantyne says women can bring a different approach to how some of the big machines are set up for students who might find them daunting.
A big stereotype that can be true is women have a little bit more caution in the spaces. And so when they come in, they have a little bit more awareness of the people who are working around them.
Another difference, she says, is women are sometimes more observant.
Something I think personally I as a woman can bring to the table is I can look around and say, like, oh, that doesn't really seem correct to me.
That focus on safety is something Jason Chow observes, too.
The women in our shop do definitely tend to take fewer stupid risks. And then also when you're training women versus training men, the women tend to actually pay a little bit more attention, I found. the woman will still actually engage with the training, whereas the man might be trying to show off the skills that he already has.
Another redesign? Students teach other students now. So whoever wants to use the plasma torch to cut metal can go to Sarah Ballantyne.
We've been able to see a transition from it being a bit more of a hardcore, mech-y, and like male-dominated space to a very open learning space for students here.
All kinds of students, Daniela Foss says.
We'd love to. I mean, I don't think computer scientists necessarily should be afraid to walk into the shop and do cool stuff.
And doing cool stuff is what Olin sees as an integral part of its educational experience.
And that was WBUR reporter Fred Tice. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our show is produced by Kathleen McNerney, Jamie Bologna, and Allison Bruzek, with help from Zoe Mitchell, Lily Tyson, and Brian Bouchard. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Deborah Becker. This is Radio Boston.